Hello and welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And I have been looking forward to this one so much that I am actually fighting through the jaw pain of fresh dental work to record this episode.
Which, like, that's a sacrifice. No one's going to take that away from you, truly. Noble work. But I as well have sacrificed an hour and 40 minutes of my life to this film. And I have a complicated relationship with this film that has grown only within the confines of the hour and 40 minutes in which I was watching it. And then I, like, went and watched an Indiana Jones film and such. But it's a complex, not entirely negative relationship. We'll get into it. But the best way to describe this film, in my opinion, is it would have been on showcase at midnight on a Wednesday or Thursday night in around 1998. And, like, it needs a little more saxophone. Apparently the composer for this film is a legendary saxophone artist. And when I read that about 20 minutes into the film, because I was like, this needs a lot of hot sax to really just like, hit that like British art, late 80s, early 90s tone that it seemed to just naturally have. Not enough saxophone from a saxophonist. What the fuck? Where's my fucking saxophone, you saxophonist?
Well, see, now, complicated is fair. If you had said that you hate this movie, I was going to come over there and punch you. But complicated is fair. Yeah,
one cannot hate this film. One can only have an interesting argument about this film. That at least it has that. You know, there's a lot of fucking shit out in the world that doesn't even bring up that. But this film absolutely does. This is Mirror Mask.
Somewhere between her imagination and reality, there is a portal beyond which all of her dreams and all of her creations come to life.
I don't really know where I am.
Follow me. It's a gateway on which the whole world balances.
From the imagination of the Jim Henson Company, the creators of The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth.
You keep talking about a charm. What kind of a charm?
It's the spellbinding fantasy of award-winning writer and master storyteller Neil Gaiman.
It's my dream. Charm was a mirror mask.
The directorial vision of renowned illustrator Dave McKeon.
She needs to grow up and come home. Go and...
Come on, Maestro, this is our big finish.
Experience an unforgettable journey through a world filled with magic, fantastic creatures, and illusion.
So, okay, first of all, the thing with this film is it was never intended for theatrical release. It's an art project. It's not a movie to go see in the theater with a popcorn and, like, have the box office go fucking whiz-bang. No, this is an art project, absolutely, and I respect it for that. We'll get into that. It has a lot going for it. This is a feature-length film with sets probably 95% of the time made entirely of CGI, like super stylized CGI, and characters in really unique-looking makeup and outfits, and very unique, therefore, like, allows it to kind of work with the dated CGI better. kind of animated characters throughout.
Yeah.
This film was made for $4 million and they managed to do that. And so for like the pure just how the fuck of it all, that's incredible. That is a commitment and passion to creativity where no single shot in this film looks the same, because at the very least, the background has been like specifically made different by someone else at some point. Incredible amount of work went into this film, and it was never meant to be considered as like technically it made less than a quarter of how much was spent on it. That's technically a failure.
Yeah.
But it's not meant to be rated that way or considered that way. So this is a very different kind of film.
Yeah, no, it did end up getting, I believe, a limited theatrical run in the States. Mm-hmm. But as you said, it was never really supposed to. In terms of release in general, I'm not sure that this was actually supposed to leave the UK.
Right? I don't know if it was supposed to leave the UK. I don't know the location of this, but I know that it debuted at a high school, like shown to the students, possibly.
I could see that.
Yeah, and like that's damn fascinating and unique. And the film, again, this is not a film in the traditional sense where people want to make money with it or win awards with it. The film is essentially a bet or a dare. An internal dare from the Jim Henson Company that like, hey, yeah. I wonder if we can make something as fucked up as like the Dark Crystal again, or, you know, just like what can we do? We have this spare $4 million. What are we capable of doing with this new technology? And a thing about the whole animation and style of this film is you have to understand this was in 2005. The year previous, we got Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, which is, I feel like this is, everyone from that era kind of gets a sucker punch. Everyone gets one film that is like super stylistic and made entirely of CGI. And for me, that's Sky Captain. For other people, such as maybe yourself, it's Mirror Mask. And for other people, such as other people, it would be literally Sucker Punch. You know, stuff like that, where others look at it and go,
yeah,
I see, but I don't get it.
Well, well, the critical thing here is that, like, did I enjoy Sucker Punch? Yes, I enjoy looking at it. Is it good? No.
But is Sky Captain good?
Now, well, Sky Captain is good to me.
Ah.
Now, Sky Captain was very much the cinematic equivalent of a 30s radio serial. Mm-hmm. Now, we've already established that I love those. I have several in a collection. And so Sky Captain was pretty much targeted towards someone like me. Did most of the mainstream audience really understand it? No.
No, they did not.
And I can see why.
Yeah, it's super stylized CGI was a thing very briefly because it was a thing that was possible. George Lucas proved it was possible.
Yeah.
But these films kind of proved via their box office, their low box office. And again, Mirror Mask is not necessarily to be counted in that way. Sky Captain was made to make money and it failed. People just, unless they specifically really love the genre or the characters or the topic or whatever, they will not show up out of curiosity for these kinds of films. It doesn't happen. And they had to really let go of that for a couple of years until they got much, much better at it. And now you can't even fucking tell. Everything's that Marvel does is filmed in, like, Atlanta. You don't know. Oh, it's Wakanda. Yeah, sure. It is.
Of course it is.
It's the I-90.
But Yeah, like for me though, Mirror Mask, on the other hand, it's one is looks incredible, but unlike Sucker Punch, I can also say that Mirror Mask is good.
Fair. And like, I can't argue against it because it is such obvious fucking art. It's not a movie like a spectacle. It is art. I can't be like, no, it's not. You're stupid. Fuck you. You know, it's art. If you enjoy it, that's, you know, that's all that you can really say about it. Like, you know, you can go on and on about why you enjoy it, but there's no argument I can have if someone is enjoying art, so long as I recognize, like, okay, yeah, no shit, that took a lot of work and a lot of commitment and passion, and it has a very stylized look that, like, is and is not Neil Gaiman. We'll get into that in a bit. But, like, because it is so... If Cirque du Soleil decided to perform this, I would not be surprised. It would just be like, oh, that makes complete sense as something that they should translate to Cirque du fucking Soleil.
Yeah, like, make no mistake. If Cirque du Soleil did their own version of Mirror Mask, I don't care whose throat I would have to slit. I would be there, front row.
Like, this movie should be in French. This movie should be in French. That should be the tagline of the movie on the poster. This movie should be in French.
As much as it is British as hell.
Yes.
I can see where you're coming from.
But like, that would make it extra great. Cause it's like a French commentary on English. Like, yeah. This movie is so oddly 80s BBC cheap late night art fair. Meant to make a point about politics or alienation in Thatcherite England that, like, people would only remember vaguely at this point. I don't know how in the hell this got made. It's so just, like, it's out of time. That's the best way to really describe it. It's out of time in a couple of ways because its story setting and designs are from the 80s. Its actual visual composition and all of the art is from the early 2000s and just completely separate. And yet that works so well to tell the story of someone who ends up in essentially in their own imaginations driven anxiety Oz.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, God, this all works. This all works in its absurdity, maybe?
Yeah, but also to just go back to something you had said earlier, it's interesting that you say that you don't know how this got made when I think you kind of touched on potentially how it got made.
Oh, I know the literal how it got made. It's more like, how did this spirit of this film be allowed to be manifest in this hyper corporate, hyper profit driven era of movies? The audacity of it.
Well, that's what I was going to, because I think the studio's logic behind this was every once in a while, Jim Henson Studios would get that script or that film idea where they're just like, okay, we got to try this.
Well, that, yeah, and like, it was definitely the, like, a film idea. So, yeah, they wanted to do something dark because it's a new generation. The generation at Jim Henson Studios at that time did not do anything dark. The darkest they had done would be, like, the Ghost of Christmas Future in A Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
That's the darkest they would have gotten, you know, and not going anywhere near, because it would have been like at this point 15 plus years before, like Dark Crystal and all those other things that I can't think of the names of right now.
Dark Crystal was I think the starting point almost for what I was talking about, where Jim Henson gets the idea for Dark Crystal. He's like, kind of really want to try it.
Mm-hmm.
You get and that's the idea for Labyrinth. I kind of really want to try it.
Labyrinth, yeah. And that's the thing. I think there's the secret sauce. This is an attempt to homage that kind of thing. But
yeah.
without Jim's incredible imagination, his twisted imagination in many ways, you can't really replicate that. And this is its own separate thing that should be like considered among like Coraline and Dr. Parnassus, I believe, you know, the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Yeah. And there was an era of kind of weird shit, semi-artistic, interesting, looking for a style, being a little daring kind of stuff. And this should stand within that. But unfortunately, it doesn't hit the mark of what the intention was in the same way as like Labyrinth and Dark Crystal. And it's really fascinating that it doesn't, because it also doesn't hit the same wavelength as like other Neil Gaiman products. There's not much, there is and is not much Gaiman in this. It feels like someone was asked to write in the style of Gaiman, but it's literally Neil Gaiman. And it's because he didn't write the story from beginning to end. He essentially was handed an idea and just went, yeah, we'll work around everything. And so you end up with like, it's kind of like a chocolate egg. So on the outside is Jim Henson Company's ideas when they're bored. And on the inside is delicious Neil Gaiman half-written script nougat.
Yeah, I think you could almost call this Neil Gaiman's Darkman, just insofar as with Darkman, you could see all the things that Sam Raimi would later bring to the Spider-Man franchise.
Yeah.
Here, you can see stylistic bits and pieces that would later at least kind of show up in something like Good Omens.
Yeah. Yeah, it has elements to it, but it's just not, there's no through line of a deeper possible expectations or meanings or sly humor. This was a very like, there's humor in it. There is.
Yeah.
But it's not the same kind of sly humor that you expect from Neil Gaiman. And I mean like the kind he had even during Sandman. It's so strange. You can recognize all the elements of his hand in play, and you can recognize all of the elements of Jim Henson, the Jim Henson Company at play, but neither of them are really. It feels like they're a simulation of each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, I can see that. Like I was just going to say, in terms of Neil Gaiman's like film and TV work, you can see this as kind of a foundational building block. He's not there yet.
Yeah.
But you can see what's going to come.
Yeah. There's potential there. But because you enjoy it so much, how about you go over the story? Because it's such a weird thing. All you can talk about is how it makes you feel and what the story is, because everything else you can't really criticize. It's such a stylistic, artistic choice. Everything is that you can't criticize the plot, because a lot of the plot is driven by the design details that you have to be watching. And those are so unique that you really can't just be like, oh, that's so lazy. It's the door that was drawn on the thing. It's like, yeah, but like, it's so stylized that you should notice it the first time you see it in the film. And it's just, it's an odd film. So yes, please give a plot rundown, because I can't criticize this, but I don't really feel comfortable with it.
So essentially, First and foremost, if you have seen and are a film of or a fan of Labyrinth or Wizard of Oz, or probably at least three or four other movies that I'm not currently thinking of, a lot of these elements are going to sound familiar. But this basically centers around our lead character of Helena, who is the daughter of circus owners, and like she's part of the circus, but it's the standard rebellious 15-year-old, I hate my life, I don't want to be here. She has a fight with her mother, who roughly 10 minutes of screen time or so later ends up passing out. It's not fully established what's wrong with her. I got the impression it was cancer.
Yeah, it's either cancer or plot convenience, because she recovers finally by the end of the film just in time and like perfectly. And it's like, ah, yes, excellent. It was only plot convenience. The surgeons were able to take care of it.
Yeah, I assume cancer, because there's a line where dad tells her, you know, mom's going to be fine. They got it all.
That makes a lot of sense. Although she hadn't gone in. Okay, yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, let's go with cancer. It's the most probable choice.
So from there, as Helena is basically trying to process everything going on around her, she ends up sliding into this world that she fairly quickly figures out is her own dream. Where she decides to journey from, is the standard, yeah, your Kingdom of Light, Kingdom of Darkness, and she goes on a journey to find, crap, I forgot the term, but I think it's originally the talisman.
Yeah.
The MacGuffin, let's be honest.
The MacGuffin, yeah. Go find the thing. Fetch me a thing.
Basically. But what we later figure out is the mirror mask that the Queen of Light can uses to keep her kingdom and everybody safe. But because the mask has been stolen by Helena's doppelganger, the Queen of Light has passed out, fallen ill, and they can't wake her up. And without her, darkness is moving in and is consuming everything. And of course, it's the standard, find the mask before it's too late. But Helena also needs to find the mask so that she can use it to get back to her own world. And along the way, you have the Wizard of Oz-esque analogs where both queens are both represented by her mother. A prime minister character shows up as her father. It's the standard, there's a dream analogs of people actually in her life. Visually, everything is pretty much based on her drawings. And a lot of it, the dream sequence, it's honestly, it's kind of hard to explain without literally sitting down and watching it.
Yeah, you have to have watched this film to really understand what we're talking about, because it might as well just be like polka dots. It's just an hour and 40 minutes of polka dots. No, it's really interesting, you know, art style that has this air of it, of like Neil Gaiman kind of like semi-dark chaos.
Yeah.
Without feeling like it's branded. Like it doesn't feel like it was come up with by committee. It actually has a unique artistic flair and touch to it. And it's darkly gorgeous. It's definitely like, you know, art of someone who is depressed, because it's super gothy. All of this is incredibly gothy, and the whole thing is dark in a sense of literally you cannot watch this in a room with a light on. You may not be able to see the screen or what is happening.
It's definitely far better to watch it with the lights off, just because especially if you've got a really nice TV, you want to be able to see everything.
Yeah, and it's there's such a heavy sepia filter on this, and corner shadows, and everything's already very dark, and it all perfectly sets an emotional tone for the place, you know, and it really allows a contrast when you are, you know, like talking to the Queen of Light and stuff, and it's like, oh, look, you can actually see light again. Photons are coming out of my television and hitting my eye once more. But it's just sad to see a necessary artistic choice to cover so much of that up, because this is 2005 CGI and the whole film was made for $4 million. So you gotta do certain things to cover it up. And it's just, God, that is such a shame, because $4 million worth of CGI now, like the same passionate commitment and talent would be so much more colorful, I hope, because it's just browns out so much. It feels like playing GTA 4.
I mean, I think more by today's standards, it's just the simple fact that even if they maintained the same tone, were this made today, they could just straight up do so much more.
Yeah. Well, and that, like, not that's not to cast shame on what they accomplished. Again, they did an hour and 40 minutes of very stylized, never repeating backgrounds and characters and really interesting different ideas that are just like, oh, cool, nightmare fuel. Light nightmare fuel, like for children. But okay, cool, neat. That's a unique idea. I've never seen that before. I'm getting vague memories every time I see the cats of like some of the advertising for this film. But like, yeah, the art in it is so terrific. And amazingly enough, the main performer who plays the girl, I can't think of her name right now.
Stephanie Leonidas.
She's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Because she interacts with nothing for over an hour's worth of performance in this film. Like, you know, green screen and maybe a tennis ball. Because this is 2005, and again, the entirety of the world she is interacting with for the vast majority of the film is all art. So, like, it's not even a matter of someone telling Ian McKellen, you're talking to this character, you're in this environment. You have to imagine and interact with abstract fucking goth art and have it be believable on screen. And it is. That kid had such wonderful spatial acting abilities.
Oh yeah, like Helena in the script is, I think, very much the standard cinematic 15-year-old girl. That said, Leonidas does take that role and just really dive in, and I don't know that role would work with anyone else.
No, it's not a very complicated role, but her ability to perform in that environment gives it more complication and makes it more interesting than it would be otherwise. Because on paper, this is a very straightforward rehashed story. Like, that's why I know the reason that they went with a circus is because it's more visually interesting, but originally it was going to be a theater, and so I think presentation is an important intrinsic part of the theme of the fucking film, and to pull off that fantastic presentation with actors who are able to work within that, it's a feat. Like, that's why I say I can't, you know, I respect this film. I don't like it in the sense of I'll never watch it again, but it's really fucking good technically in every way, except it needs more saxophone.
Trivia side note. If you've ever watched the Canadian sci-fi series Killjoys, the character in season two that's used to introduce the hack mods, Clara, who's basically a mercenary with a big chain gun for an arm, That's Stephanie Leonidas. That's Helena.
Okay, cool. Neat.
So, just if anybody's curious, she is still working today.
Well, that's good. I mean, like,
yeah,
I completely understand why critics were like pretty much 50-50 on this film, because I'm 50-50 on this film. You recognize its feats, talents, and genius, and then you go, it's just a shame they didn't have more money, time, or like it wasn't built from the ground up in a different way that would have like maybe supported a more robust narrative than semi Wizard of Oz.
Oh yeah, no, this is semi Wizard of Oz. This is, if your kids enjoyed Labyrinth, but they start telling you that like, oh no, that's kid stuff, I don't want to watch that, pull out Mirror Mask.
Show them something semi dark and spooky and confusing. Make sure it's after 11. And make sure it's on a night where they want to stay up late and like they're kind of fighting for it, and be like, fine, we'll watch what used to be on TV this time of night when I was a kid. Here's some light trauma.
Yeah, there's a reason that this was sold in a DVD 3-pack with The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. This is absolutely like a DLC.
there's a reason that a lot of people were convinced that Mirror Mask was a sequel to Labyrinth or a spiritual successor. Like the movies have no actual connection whatsoever.
Yeah.
But you can 100% see the DNA of Labyrinth in this movie.
Oh yeah, no. This is an homage in genre. It has nothing to do itself on any visual level with The Dark Crystal or Labyrinth, but in tone and audience, that would be children and dark, not dark like fucking violent and gore. Dark as in semi-disturbingly designed and sinister, paranoia-driven kind of stuff that a kid could understand, even though it has to do with a reverse world in your drawings and a doppelganger version of yourself who is a princess who wants to take over your life. That makes logical, terrifying nightmare sense to a child.
Oh, yeah. And like where Labyrinth was very much essentially Sarah's processing and accepting the fact that, you know, she's growing up and she can let go of her childhood things, but they will still be there if she needs them. Here is Helena essentially processing a traumatic event.
She kind of knocks herself out a little bit. And she has a wobbly dream. That's all this is. It's a wobbly dream, you know, like she's having a fever dream. And at the end of it, everything's fine. And she comes to understand herself a little bit. And maybe she willed into being another person. It's fine. We don't have to ask that question too closely. Terrifying.
But also, speaking of that person, Jason Barry as Helena's not quite sidekick, Valentine.
Friend, traveler, betrayer, finally boyfriend?
Ish?
Waiter at an Italian restaurant?
But I just want to mention Barry. Like, I just enjoyed him in the first time I watched this movie, he just gave me such a British Matt Frewer vibe.
This is such an odd film, because like the biggest name in it is, I can't even remember his name. He's on panel shows, like British panel shows, and he plays like in groups of like ensembles of comedians. The father character.
The father is the biggest name in this movie? I would have thought you were going to go with Stephen Fry.
Oh, yeah. Stephen Fry makes a cameo, but he's not on camera, and I hate Stephen
Fry.
Fair. Yeah.
Okay, fair. Fair.
But knowing that,
your choice makes more sense.
Yeah. But yeah, Stephen Fry is in it very briefly in a very obvious cameo that also, when you're watching it, you could completely believe was from like a CD-ROM, like an Encarta CD-ROM from around 1996.
I mean, I was going to say BBC documentary narrator, but...
Ooh, even better.
Yeah.
Douglas Adams funded BBC...
Yes.
History and Encyclopedia CD-ROM set. There we go.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Rob Brydon as the dad, he's another one of those, doesn't get much to work with, but he's doing a lot with everything that he's given.
Yeah, no, Rob Zoe's great. I joke about the panel shows, but I watch the panel shows. That's how I know he's on the panel shows. He's charming in a very like kind of inoffensive way. And I think that works great for his character, as thin as it is, because the problem is between the daughter and the mother. So being ineffectual and kind of waifish himself in terms of like character, he just takes it. That there's a man who takes it in the relationship and it works.
He's the dad who's like struggling to hold everything together, but he doesn't quite know how to keep everything together. But you root for him because you can see that he is trying.
Yeah, but most importantly though, it serves as a contrast that shows the strength of will of the daughter, and therefore you get a richer character out of her, so you don't need it out of him.
Also true. But also, Gina McKee is the mom. She's probably the luckiest cast member because she has so much to do, so much to try to carry.
Yeah, she has the more interesting performances and the more kind of like she's the plot driver and the craver of the MacGuffin and the primary antagonist outside of the later revealed primary antagonist. So she's having a lot of fun, and for the first two acts she's definitely like the center of most attention, and when she's not in it or people aren't talking about her, it definitely drags sometimes. Not visually, just dialogue.
And also the simple fact, there's a moment where toward the start of the movie where she's taking tickets for the circus, has to leave the ticket booth to go find her daughter, and grabs the mime to get him to come and sell tickets.
Yeah, which is cruel. Just cruel.
It's like, the way the scene comes off, it makes sense, but it shouldn't.
Yeah.
And there's also just that little moment of the guy buying the tickets for his family, trying to deal with this mime, and there's that split second where he's looking around like, help?
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's a cute moment. It's a cute little character moment. It's very Hallmark level joke and filming, like the framing of it for some reason, even the camera, just the clarity of it was like, oh, I'm watching a Hallmark movie. Fascinating. It kind of works in that sense. And because this whole film is so artsy fartsy kind of, you know, whatever, that allows it to work. But yeah, like, holy shit, you better be sold out, because that mime is not going to fucking sell a single ticket, and you have pissed off lined up customers. That's not good business. That's why you're going under.
Yeah, and even if they're not pissed off, they're like at the bare minimum thoroughly confused.
Yeah, and I put that entirely on the mime. The very moment that happened, I got annoyed at the mime for fucking about instead of correctly miming the interaction and then going about it that way. That would have been funny. Just like a mime doing like math in front of people so that they could understand it, and then like continuing the transaction. It's a different kind of funny. Yes, it's not so much the silliness. Yes, I know. It's nitpicking. Yes, I know. That mime should have been a clown that spoke French. This film should be in French. And like have it be a choice of Helena. She's rebelling against her English working class circus performing family. She's decided that everything is in French because she's 13 and pretentious.
Well, 15 and pretentious, but still.
Whatever. And thus. Yeah.
But yeah, and like main thing for me is now, as much as I've said, I love this movie. I'm kind of where you are in terms of rewatching it, in that I would never say that I would never watch this again, but I can have no problem going years between viewings, because this is the equivalent, the film equivalent of going to the art gallery. You will go. You will thoroughly enjoy it. You will quite probably appreciate the art more every time you go. You ain't going on a weekly basis.
Yeah, if you go again next week, you might see a different part of the exhibit. But if you go again the next week, you're seeing the same everything. Wow, yep. That painting that hasn't changed in 400 years still hasn't changed. Neat.
Yeah, exactly.
I wish someone would steal it.
I mean, I've probably seen Mirror Mask 4, maybe 5 times, and I would have gotten the DVD in probably 2008.
Lots of potential for rewatch. I've worn out DVDs in that time. Lord knows everyone has. You have your favorites. But yeah, this is it's everyone has their artsy choices, and everyone has their aesthetic for aesthetic only choices, and like people who love a thing because, like, you know, of the exact time that they found it, or the design choice then. There's 1,000 ways and 1,000 reasons, and so there's no way to really rate this film in any way, just like there's no way to really criticize any aspect of this film. Like we've talked about a bunch of aspects of this film, but we've not aside from the lack of the fucking jazz music. This needs more saxophone. Like, and that's a joke. That's, you know, it's me playing up to a cliche of a certain art type from the late 80s, but it's not an actual flaw of the film. There are no flaws in this film. It's a $4 million art project. If it had been a giant red ball sitting in the middle of Madrid, Spain, and cost $4 million, it would have the same, like inability to be criticized. Because it's a $4 million giant fucking ball sitting in the middle of Madrid. That is why, you know, why is Mirror Mask? Because Mirror Mask is. Oh, okay. all right, it doesn't need to justify itself, and any critique rolls off its back as, I don't give a fuck.
Oh, yeah, and while we're on the subject of art, I've never quite figured this out myself, so I'm wondering if maybe you know. The two giants that they get the key from?
Yeah.
Was that inspired by an actual sculpture of some sort?
I want to say probably, because it did seem awfully familiar.
Yeah, that's the thing that I was having with it, because I'm looking and it's like, something about it just says, I've seen them somewhere else.
Right, and I would suspect that the style was being homaged more of something, more than an actual sculpture, because nothing else in this whatsoever feels like a direct, I'm going to take that and do it my way kind of thing. It, you know, yeah, like in terms of references to art. So I would be very surprised if they just decide to do that for this character who is like at the semi-climax, at the build-up climax, the MacGuffin climax, in many ways, semi, kind of. It's two giants. It's hard to miss them. And so thus, considering the impact they have on the plot and the size of them and in the scene and the composition of their character, like actually having them be semi-interesting, I would say it's got to be a reference in style, not necessarily form, because they don't do form in the rest of the fucking film. Those cats aren't a reference to anything. What the shit?
No, that makes sense. And I love, like, I kind of, in all honesty, wish that I could buy Helena's art.
This would be, I mean, it's a shame that this is all digital, because if you could sell this film off cell by cell, that would be really fucking lucrative.
Oh, yeah, no, make no mistake. I would still frame that.
Yeah, I presume somewhere there has to be, like, the art director's fucking, like design specs and like design Bible and a bunch of shit that could be purchased. But because this film, again, was not made for profit with the intent of ever making profit or being merchandised, I don't know how the fuck you would ever buy that.
I think that's one of those, I'd have to look online, because as you're saying that, I'd swear I have seen a Mirror Mask art book at some point.
Like, that might be the closest you can get if they released The Art of the Mirror Max. Mirror Max. It's a very 90s Mirror Max movie. We swung for the fences. This is a tax dodge, isn't it? Yes. Also, I'm fucking the actress of the mother. Of course you are, Ivory. You fucking rapist bastard.
Yeah. Needless to say, fuck Harvey Weinstein.
Fuck Harvey Weinstein.
May he rot away and do us all a favor and die in jail.
Huzzah.
But yeah, no, like, I have the soundtrack around here somewhere. This is, every once in a while, this is that movie that you can pull out and just put on, I honestly hope Disney will let Jim Henson Studios or whatever that company, whatever banner they're under now. I would love it if Disney would let them, like, not remake Mirror Mask. Because as much as I would love to see what this would look like with today's technology, Mirror Mask is, like we said with Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, it's a benchmark film. And nearly 20 years later, I think it's time for another truly creative, entirely original benchmark film.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that, where it's like, you know, it's been two decades. You've had a lot of churn in creative talent, and now you have very different restrictions and responsibilities to a higher corporate overlord who will not spend $4 million on your fucking art project. it would be interesting to see what they could do, and I just hope that it wouldn't be... Well, I guess they already did that. A sequel to The Dark Crystal. We'll just put it on Disney Plus. It's cool. Don't worry. Or maybe it was The Labyrinth. I can't fucking remember. They did a new live action version of it, and we're like, it's the new hotness. Remember The Dark Crystal? And everyone went, I love The Dark Crystal. And they went, do you love this? And people went, I forgot about it a week after I watched it.
Well, if we're thinking of the Netflix series, that was a prequel.
Oh, that's the one. Forgot about it the week after I watched it. Did not matter. Not a benchmark. At least I'll remember this insanity. No, wait. Instead of Showcase, I think, now that I think about it, remember the first year or two of Teletoon? When it was just... anything we could get at all.
Yeah, yeah.
This would be their 11 p.m. movie.
I could see that.
Yeah. Like, it's just dark and creepy enough that, like, we'll show it at night. Whatever. If we're not going to spook the kids too badly. But it's animated enough that they could put it under their budget and be like, no, it's fine. I'm pretty sure it got donated part of a trust. Like, who the fuck's going to sue you over shooting this movie illegally? No one.
Well, I'm sure Disney could find a way, because, I mean, they're Disney, but...
Do they own this? It's not on Disney Plus.
Oh, well, that's just a crime. I think that this may be similar to what's going on with The Shadow, where, if I remember right, Sony owns it, but I think it's so buried in their library that they started to build the property back up and then just forgot about it.
See, I suspect it's probably closer to, like, Todd McFarlane claiming he owns, like, Angela and shit. And he's in a fight with Alan Moore over, like, Medieval Spawn and all that crap. And then it turns out, buried under all the contract law, it's discovered Neil Gaiman owns it all. And so Neil Gaiman being involved in this, turns out it's all mine. Yeah.
Which, frankly, I would almost hope that if Disney actually does not own Mirror Mask, please, for the love of God, let it belong to Neil Gaiman.
And please let him have better taste than the people he went with for American Gods.
What the hell did he go with for American Gods?
The people who do Walking Dead.
Oh, AMC?
Yeah, AMC. And the first two seasons were great because they had a great showrunner and it was like hyper against like racism and shit. And then they brought in a guy who literally called all that stuff woke and it tanked so hard. Orlando Jones was fired and he was the best part of the show.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Well, if the recent first season of Sandman was any indication, and if Good Omens is any indication, I'm willing to assume that Gaiman has learned a thing or two.
Which just means, goddamn. Which just means it's time to redo American Gods.
Frankly, yeah. When I say that this is British as can be, I mean this is so British that I am pretty sure Doctor Who pulled from it. Because the Series 6 episode Night Terrors.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the apartment building where that takes place, the exterior shots, at least, I'm fairly certain were the same building that Helena lives in. And then the bits of the idea of the flying fish shows up and plays prominently in Doctor Who's version of A Christmas Carol. And then, of course, Neil Gaiman's also written for Doctor Who.
I do remember, I think people even said at the time, possibly, that the episode where, the kids' drawings come to life, kind of, was intentionally meant to be a message, like a reference to it. And it's like, oh, okay. I didn't watch that movie. Okay.
Yeah, Fear Her. Fear Her is one of the Series 2 episodes we don't really talk about.
Yeah, it's not a good one by any regard.
It's generally rather disliked. Like, for me personally, it's an episode that's kind of, it's just there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's forgettable. And if you do remember it, you probably don't like it.
Yeah, generally. But yeah, with this, I wanted to bring this one because specifically this needs to be experienced. And I think digitally it's like $3 or $4 to rent. You could probably find a physical copy like in the bargain bin for $5. So you are not only not being put out financially at all, but it's going to be a very good use of your $5.
Yeah, it's definitely worth $5. I'll give it $5. Yeah. My rating is $5. Well, you owe me some movies I actually want to see. What are we watching next?
Sticking with, as I said previously, our final three are films that to me are just pure art. So next up we'll be going to something that I had talked about reviewing earlier, but could never quite figure out how to fit it in, which was the 2022 animated film out of, I believe, Ireland, Wolfwalkers.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, all right. Again, another film I have not seen and I vaguely am aware of, but haven't seen any promotional material either. So, neat.
Yeah, this was another one that, if I remember right, critically did do quite well. But the budget, shall we say, did not go into the marketing.
Well, that's good with an animated film. I prefer it go elsewhere.
Oh yeah.
Cool. Well, that to look forward to while I go and scrub my brain. Yay! And if you'd like to scrub your brain too, why not write into us and we'll send you some brain soap. It's not drugs, I promise. Contact us at...
Well, let's be honest, it's totally drugs, and you can reach us for, well, preferably not drugs, because that would be illegal, at realgeekshfx@gmail.com, or on Twitter at realgeekshfx. You can find me at the Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, technically Hive, and Mastodon that I like never check, as well as now finally officially I am on Blue Sky.
Isn't it neat? Isn't it quiet?
Frankly, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a calm green meadow. It's just kind of like they actually no. What they should have called it is Fiddler's Green, because that. That Neil Gaiman character is exactly what popped into my mind when I first like experienced it. And you're going around, you're like, it's just so nice. And people are being so nice and nothing's a fight. And it even just, it feels like, Whom?
Yeah, literally the worst thing that I can say about Blue Sky so far is that they call messages, they refer to messages as skeets.
Yeah.
And I can't hear that without thinking of Lil Jon.
Yeah, and that's intentional. Hopefully they change that. Hopefully.
I mean, skywriting is right there.
And I can be found at Friday in Halifax on Twitter and Crash and Burn everywhere else, including Blue Sky. Yeah. We're special.
Just